from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Today in Turkey, police made a series of arrests in the assassination of the Russian ambassador there. He was shot yesterday.
There have been concerns throughout Europe that Christmas markets were going to be targets of terrorism.
See, now we're feeling what not having hope feels like.
The vote for President of the United States was 20 votes for Donald J. Trump, and the vote for Vice President for the United States, 20 votes for Michael R. Pence.
People feel as if they're not being heard. And where Democrats are characterized as coastal, liberal, latte-sipping, politically correct, out-of-touch folks.
No latte sipping here in the Wheelhouse this morning. As usual, Colin McEnroe is here. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi, Colin.
Full disclosure, I did sip a latte about an hour and a half ago.
See, that's exactly what he's talking about.
And I am out of touch, too.
Tom Dudzik is here. He's never out of touch. He's the editor and entrepreneur behind ctcapitalreport.com. Good to see you, Tom.
Good morning, John. And not a latte sipper here either.
No. And Dan Haar, he's got his big mason jar filled with what looks like either iced tea or bourbon. He, of course, covers a lot of things for the Hartford Courant. He's a columnist there. Hey, Danny.
It's too early for iced tea.
We should actually put a photo of Dan's jar up on Facebook and have people guess what's in it.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
Maybe
it's a nondescript liquid.
I will say in a little bit we'll talk about the prospects for Connecticut's current governor staying in his job, also some of the issues that might be on our radar in the next few months at the state capitol. If you want to join the conversation, as always, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. One of the big news stories of the week, of course, this Monday, the Electoral College voted. Donald Trump indeed voted in as the next president of the United States. This from the New York Times. While Mr. Trump's opponents needed 37 Republican defectors to bring his electoral vote tally below 270, the bulk of electors who broke ranks, four in Washington state, were Democrats who otherwise would have voted for Ms. Clinton. Instead, they voted for former Republican Secretary of the State Colin Powell and Faith Spotted Eagle, a Native American tribal leader who's led opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. You wrote about this last Sunday, Colin. We weren't expecting anything other than that to happen, but any other takeaways from our close reading of the Electoral College, something that happens seemingly every couple of years in America now. We don't pay much attention to it, and then we pay a whole bunch of attention to it on a Monday.
Right. Before I get to that, I did want to just say for NPR listeners, even though she has changed her name to Faith Spotted Eagle, she'll continue to host the Food Schmooze, and it'll be unchanged.
That's actually not true. That's fake news right there.
So that's fake news. So, yeah, I mean, I guess speaking of out of touch, I mean, if you read a lot of the coverage heading into Monday, you would have concluded that there were going to be substantial defections from Trump to Clinton among electoral voters, and Lawrence Lessig was floating the number 20, which seems turns out to have been based on absolutely nothing. And, you know, I mean, I think this betokens a couple of things. I mean, one of them is obviously people are kind of operating on hope and dreams right now as opposed to reality. You can't blame them. You know, they're scared. They're alarmed. They're appalled. The other thing is, though, I feel as though one of the things that emerges from all this is the large number of Americans, and no one should be surprised, but the large number of Americans who kind of don't know how their own process works. You know, people are perennially shocked to find out how the Electoral College works. I got an email from a very nice person, and I'm not making fun of him at all. I don't really know him anyway, but I'm not making fun of him. But he said, you know, he was heading up to the state capitol for the rally to get in the Trump electors to change their votes to Clinton, and was I going to be at that rally? And I wrote back and I said, look, there aren't any Trump electors in Connecticut. That's not how it works. And then he sent me another email, I think today or yesterday, saying, you know, based on what I said, he decided not to go up there, but somebody he knew did go up there and couldn't find the rally. I'm thinking, you know, I'm not saying this caused any of the problems, but if you want to be effective now, if you feel as though you want reform and different outcomes in the midterm elections and different outcomes in 2020, you could maybe start with a level engagement where you basically just knew how the game is played. And I do think maybe that's something that it would be nice if people built on whatever awareness they achieved during this period of, you know, being vexed about the Electoral College.
Maybe in a little bit we'll talk about something that's proposed to be changed at the state capitol having to do with early voting, maybe getting us get engaged in a different way. Just before we started, though, Tom, you were talking about how close we really were, if you think about it, from a very different outcome, from sitting here talking about something entirely different today.
Right. And, you know, here we have this conversation across America and in Connecticut about Donald Trump and, you know, the move of the country to the right and all the voters that voted for Donald Trump. But I sit around saying, you know, had Hillary Clinton not become the nominee and Bernie Sanders would have eked it out, there's a great good probability that he may have won the race against Donald Trump. Certainly all the polling show that. And we'd be sitting here having the exact opposite conversation about, oh, how progressive America is and everyone's voting to the left and he was $15 minimum wage and right down the list of all the liberal touchstones. So it is a game of inches.
So what I said at the time was I'd still be wringing my hands because, as Colin said, it is about reality. One factoid that came out this past week, 52% of Republicans think Trump won the popular vote. That was a survey by Qualtronics, which I have not heard of, but it was widely reported. And that's sort of telling of the whole thing. You know, people don't understand not only how things happen, but what happened at all.
the actual things that happened.
And I think your friend went to Capitol lunch. That was the problem up the street.
You know, just to build on your point for a second here. I mean, first of all, you know, we finally do have, I think, something close to final certification of the popular vote. And, you know, and Clinton, it looks like Clinton won by about 2.9 million now, very close to three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, another thing people may not have understood, I mean, 7.8 million people, 5.7% of the total vote, voted for candidates other than the two top nominees. You know, that may have had a pretty substantial effect. When you start talking about those narrow margins in battleground states, that may have had a substantial effect, too. And I do think it's important to define this election one way, at least the way I define it, which I think everybody should define it that way,
which is
a very unpopular candidate was edged out by another unpopular candidate. Two unpopular candidates with very high negatives were running for president. It was a very close vote. People wound up, you know, on an electoral vote basis preferring one of the unpopular candidates. But for anyone to imagine, as Donald Trump and his supporters do, that this is a landslide, that this is a claim, this is a mandate, is, you know, back to you, Danny, a departure from reality.
Speaking of departures from reality, a concern that foreign propaganda is undermining national security, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy is highlighting new legislation that aims to combat the spread of fake news. This is from the Hartford Courant, the bipartisan measure co-sponsored with Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, bolsters the efforts by the State Department's Global Engagement Center to counter disinformation. It will also help underwrite independent journalism in small countries with fragile democracies that do not have a tradition of robust free press and could be vulnerable to meddling by Russia and China. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, sort of the obvious retort to that is we have enough problems with the media in our country that we don't have to go worry. Not that I'm isolationist about where we help, and I'm certainly not loath to spending money in the rest of the world, but the idea that we need to go help other countries with their democracy at this point does not seem.
But I listen. I aggregate news on a daily basis, and people send me fake stuff all the time. And I'm amazed every single day I read Facebook, people retweeting and sharing information that is patently false. I read on someone's Facebook feed about how A-list celebrity A, you know, was stranded in Middletown on the side of the road, and the good people of Middletown stopped and helped Adam Sandler fix his tire, and he tweeted out, "Thank you, these great people of Middletown." Well, if you Google that, actor stops on side of road, there's numerous stories out there that is just fake, and
it's always Middletown for some reason. Middletown always gets it.
It's City X, and so but people aren't vigilant, and these people put this on Facebook, so they share the stories, and goes, "We love you, Middletown. You're great people," and it's all fake. Fake.
Well, it's okay, but is Chris Murphy's plan to counter global fake news through some sort of international effort funded by American taxpayers the way to go about solving this problem, Colin?
I worry about that. I worry about it specifically. This is something that we covered on the Scramble on Monday because, in fact, there's a bill awaiting President Obama's signature. It's a big defense bill, but inside it is a clause which changes the structure under which Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Marti, and some of the the other government news operations are managed. They've been managed by, you know, a pretty diverse board of governors until now. In the interest of streamlining things, they are going to be managed now by one presidential appointee. This probably seemed like a good idea when everybody thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. Now, you know, I mean, that the notion that the government should get in the news business in a corrective way is disturbing. I'm already worried about what this means. I mean, the Voice of America and all these Radio Free Europe, they've always been independent news organizations with very high news standards, very comparable to the BBC or NPR, or, I mean, some people probably listening think that NPR is hopelessly biased. But Voice of America, you know, stuff like that, very independent. To turn those, to give those organizations an agenda other than just getting news to people who don't otherwise have access to unmanaged news is a little worrisome to me.
Well, I thought Voice of America originally was part of the arsenal of the Cold War, and in an independent way. That is, they weren't told you need to give this propaganda. But propaganda is a funny thing. When it comes from your side, it doesn't seem like propaganda. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I would hold that up as a beacon of independent news. I think more to the point here in respect to news consumption, we in a number of areas over the next 4 years will have to learn what it means to take action as consumers. Environmental protection, for example, there's plenty that people can do on their own to help protect the environment without help from the government, which we will not get over the next 4 years. And that applies, I think, to news as well.
I want to quickly move to a couple of stories that normally in the wheelhouse we wouldn't necessarily tackle, but they have made me feel at least, and I don't want to hear from the rest of the panel, that this already kind of tenuous world is on a little bit of a brink of chaos. A truck drove through a crowd at a holiday market in Berlin, killing 12 people, wounding many others. The suspect is now today a Tunisian who sought asylum there. ISIS has taken credit for inspiring that attack. That's happening the same day that the Russian ambassador to Turkey is assassinated in a very violent and in a terrible way that's captured on tape. And the off-duty Turkish police officer who assassinated him yelling about Syria and the involvement of Russia in Syria. I don't know, Colin, just to me, these two things taken in the context of everything else going on had the little bit of a feel of a start of something that is troubling. I'm not exactly sure if it's any more troubling than the other horrifying things that we've seen happening through 2016, but they had that feel to me.
Right. So that's the question. When we see these kinds of things, do we assign more importance to them because we feel anyway for other reasons, like we're on the eve of destruction? Would we have felt the same way about these two news events had they occurred in June, you know, or last February or something? You know, the assassination, I think, does bring up a stir of echoes about the events precipitating World War One. I think it's also amplified by the just incredible pictures that came out of that. That's just one of those events where the photographers had something to work with that made the whole thing just seem so much more alarming and shocking. Not that it wasn't alarming and shocking on its own. You know, as far as Berlin goes, I mean, obviously it's a big problem for Angela Merkel. It just creates kind of an attack point against her refugee policies. I don't know if it's a bigger thing than that. I mean, look, there's going to be kind of, you know, there are going to be terrorist hits. There are going to be things that are done like this for decades to come. I mean, that's sort of the world we live in right now. I don't know that this is particularly a game changer.
And I'm wondering, Tom, you know, later on in the program, we're going to try to talk about maybe some of the nicer news stories, or at least some of the news stories that caught our attention throughout the course of this year. Do you get a sense as you look through so much news that we are on a little bit of an eve of destruction in some ways? The mood of America post-election, some of the things that we're seeing, the horrifying scenes coming from Aleppo, Syria, an assassination, another terrorist attack, or does it feel like business as usual right now?
Well, I think a lot of us kind of get desensitized to all this incredible bad news. And you know, as I look, you know, towards the new year and the new Trump administration, I'm curious to see how Trump is going to handle this. There's a lot on his that's been put on his plate over the last week that he's not going to be able to deal with by a mere tweet. So, I mean, that's going to be an interesting, you know, next couple of months.
Since we're talking a lot about reality and perception, it struck me when I watched the video of the assassination in Turkey that it was not hard, impossible to discern the difference between that video and what we see, you know, day after day on shows like Homeland. And I don't know that that helps desensitize us, the existence of you know, that's obviously a huge genre in popular culture right now. And there it was in front of us, real. And I don't know if I'm the only person who looked at it and said it visually and in respect to the timing, it was absolutely identical to what we see every night on TV.
Right. And I think, you know, there's a sort of Don DeLillo-esque sense that we are just constantly prepared for the kinds of tragedies we eventually encounter. Everybody who went through 9/11 that I've ever talked to had at least one moment where they thought briefly that they might be in a movie because they'd seen this movie before somehow, you know, and it didn't seem as though it belonged in the world of real events. It seemed so garish and bizarre and extreme. It must be one of the movies that I've watched. And increasingly, the most garish and extreme movies that we've watched make themselves flesh in our world.
Mm. I want to quickly get to a phone call before I break. Molly's calling from New Haven. Hey, Molly.
Hi.
Hi, what's up? You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call. This is a remark for Colin McEnroe. He had used the example of a gentleman that was headed up to the rally as sort of you know, an example of someone that maybe could have been better educated on the issue before taking action. And I just wanted to kind of wanted to invert that. I think that people that are seeking to take action right now might also be looking for communities in which to educate themselves. Communities, you know, of action often really value the further educating themselves alongside people. So I don't know. I guess I just felt like maybe we could use some good measure in distributing snark on those that currently have hope and are seeking communities of action. Because some people are just being called to action now, and it's risky to kind of move forward and educate yourself as you go. And I think those people are very important right now. And so,
well, Molly, I appreciate your thought. A quick comment from Colin. I think
Molly, I did try to keep my comment as snark free as possible, and I think I said I think this person seemed like a very nice person and a person, you know, legitimately concerned. But I think you're right. By the way, somebody suggested this to me as a show topic within the last 24 hours, that people now want to take a kind of action, a kind of grassroots action that maybe they haven't in the past. They want to know how they can affect change, how they can alter the outcome of midterm elections or initiatives that might take place in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, what works and what doesn't. Cokie Roberts actually fielded a similar question this morning on Morning Edition. And I think I want to do that show. I think it's, you know, it is an important show to do. But, I mean, I'm not going to back off from what I said before. There's sort of no excuse for not understanding how electoral votes are allocated in a presidential election in which you're participating. And if you don't understand those things, if you've gone through life, you know, just deciding to ignore that kind of stuff, you are going to get brought up short sometimes. And I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a civics deficit in this country. People do not understand how their government works or how their political process works. And that contributes to some of the unfavorable or distasteful results.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Dan Harr is here from the Hartford Current. Tom Dudchick from CT Capital Report. We're going to turn to the Connecticut State Capitol, talk about the prospects for another Governor Malloy term. Also look at some of the things that may be on or off the table during this upcoming legislative session. You can join us here on The Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're joined today by Dan Harr from the Hartford Current, Tom Dudchick from ctcapitalreport.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. What is on your show today, Colin?
We are, in the spirit of the season, going to be talking about Jesus, but specifically with a guy who's written a book about being a secular follower of Jesus. He believes that the teachings of Jesus are exactly what the world needs now. He just doesn't happen to think that Jesus was in any way divine or that he came back from the dead or anything like that. We'll have him on with a couple of theologians, and we'll talk Jesus.
That sounds pretty good.
The biggest problem is I've got the Johnny Cash version of Your Own Personal Jesus stuck in my head for the last 18 hours.
I've got a whole bunch of Jesus songs I can get you, but that would probably take up the entire hour. Okay, so we've been talking a lot over the course of the last couple of weeks about whether or not we're going to see Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy. actually run again. Dan Haar, you've been thinking about this a little bit. You know, what sort of position do we have the governor in as we head into this legislative session? Obviously, this enormous budget deficit that we're facing. Obviously, a new type of state Senate, not entirely controlled by Democrats anymore. What do you see as the governor's prospects moving forward through the session to get things done? And also, is he running again?
Well, I think nobody knows whether he's running again. The economy has to pick up. We're a great number on unemployment. The problem is we're losing people, and that's one of the reasons unemployment is so low. The income tax came in $800 million lower than projected last year. If that happens again, then he won't be running.
I'm just going to stop you again real quick. I always talk about this. How is it we keep getting these projections so incredibly wrong? The projections of income tax revenues have been wrong consistently for the last 4, 5, 6, I don't know how many years.
Channeling Keith Faniff here, I believe that the thing called estimates and finals, which is basically capital gains and dividends, is a shockingly high proportion of the income tax. It's something like 30%. If Keith were here, he would say it's 38 or 42.
Point three,
right. But it is a very high percentage, and that is extremely volatile. And so it is the volatility in capital gains and dividends and other so-called non-earned income, the investment income, that leads to the volatility in the projections. That and the fact that we don't know what's happening. We do know what's happening and isn't good, but it's hard to catch a falling knife. It's hard to project when things are declining. When things are changing so fast and they're declining, it's hard to project that. But in any case, that's not going to be that's going to be something we're going to be looking at very closely. January 15th is an important day, and that's when the fourth quarter report on just those things I was talking about comes out. And if it's a good number, we're going to have a slightly better year. We're not going to have a good year because of the $1.4 billion projected shortfall, but that's going to determine whether the governor runs in 2018.
Do you think that that's true, Tom? Is that what makes up the governor's mind?
Well, no. I think the governor makes up his mind based on what the governor wants to do. And I think that, you know, the whole business of trying to predict what people do based on what happened this last election, I think we have to throw everything out the window. The governor, obviously, right now needs to maintain his position as the leader of the Democratic Party, the state of Connecticut, without being seen as a lame duck as he puts together this budget process. So this could kind of be like a little head fake, but yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if he decided to run, really.
You really?
Yeah. It's one of these things where, see, because everyone believes that 2018 is going to be a Republican year. So if you're a Democratic office holder, you know, would you risk your career on running for an effort that you may not win? Having said that, the governor, you know, he kind of is a contrarian. So he may just say, well, I'm going to do it again.
Well, 2018 is a Republican year. I don't know. Those midterm elections, Colin, we just said in the first segment, unpopular president. It feels to me like that might be the time at which there's a groundswell of support for a change. And that change happens at the congressional level. It might happen in the state houses, too.
Well, as you know from the emails we sent this week, I'm of the head fake school. I mean, I always say that if you want to understand how things operate up at the state capitol, you should watch as many episodes of The Dog Whisperer as you can, and fewer listen to EJ Dionne and David Brooks a lot less. I mean, you know, it's a dog pack up there, and if you're the weak dog, you know, they're not going to follow you. So I think Malloy has to send some signals that he might run, because that gives him leverage. That makes him dangerous. That means, you know, it might be a mistake to cross him. You kind of have to you just can't be up there, as Tom is suggesting, as this guy who's, you know, got an exit strategy. That just doesn't really work. Not in a dog pack. And so and the other thing part of this is, if he does run, he'll be primaried by somebody. Maybe Kevin Lembo will, you know, observe the kind of pecking order and stuff like that and defer. But, you know, Dan Drew somebody's going to primary him. He'd be pretty vulnerable. And then if he got into a general, he'd be pretty vulnerable. And I don't know. I'm just assuming this is a guy who should be, anyway, looking at his transition out of public life into private life. He's got the, you know, approval rating of shingles, and you don't want to be looking for your job at a law firm after getting your ass whooped in your final election.
He's not Chris Christie. We can say that. 19%. I want to make two sort of opposite points about the prospects when you look at the electoral picture. The first is that essentially all delegates at the conventions in Connecticut are super delegates, because we're not electing delegates from a primary into a convention. It's the opposite. The convention meets and then the primary may happen based on what the delegates. So all delegates are superdelegates. That favors the governor. The other is what happened in 2016 with the presidential election. And I think the Democrats have learned that if you sit on your hands out of deference to what looks like an inevitable candidate, what happens will happen. And I think there will inevitably. I don't think Kevin Limbaugh, he seems to be saying that if the governor wants to run or if the lieutenant governor wants to run Nancy Wyman, that he won't run. But somebody from the left will, should, and must step up. I think that should happen, but I think that will happen.
Who are the people on the left?
Well, I mean, you know, I part company. I don't see anyone from the left who has an appetite for getting in. Most of the people who would get in are in already as far as, you know, elected officials. You would have to leave your position to run. That's a very dangerous thing. People who are in the state Senate, people who are in the House of Representatives, people who are controller, people who are attorney general, they don't want to leave those jobs with the thought that they could possibly lose and then their career is kaput. So it's a risk-averse group up there.
I agree with that.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the things that may or may not come up during this legislative session, including one that Governor Malloy has been a little bit outspoken about. He blasted the possible legalization of recreational marijuana. He said, and this is from the Hartford Courant, first of all, I think it's a mistake what Massachusetts has done and other states have done. I think we should hit the pause button and watch how it works in the region. I think it's a mistake. I thought over the course of the last couple of years, Tom, every single time we came around to budget shortfalls, we were grabbing money from Keno. We were trying to move money around. We're trying to grab potential tax revenue anywhere we could so that we didn't have to raise the income tax on people. And as Danny said, maybe force more people out of the state. Why are we hitting the pause button on the possibility of legal weed?
Well, and the toothpaste is out of the tube, Governor. And you know the problem is you can't sit there and say, well, we're going to build a third casino to protect our borders from money going to Massachusetts and Springfield. You can't say we want to keep our package stores open on Sundays because people are going over the border for booze. You can't say we're going to lower the minimum pricing on alcohol because people are going over the borders and then say, oh, but guess what? You can smoke and buy marijuana in Massachusetts. We're not going to do that in Connecticut. Let them go across the state. So there's where the argument falls down.
And what I will say, Colin, is, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, the little bit that I know about the Massachusetts plan suggests that the governor might be right in terms of the tax implications. The way Mass did it, they've not taxed it at a very high rate. They don't expect to get anywhere near the type of state income that, say, a Colorado or a Washington state did when they did it. So maybe the Massachusetts plan isn't the right plan. But does that mean it should be completely off the table?
You know, I said this before, but I mean, this is a laboratory experiment that's being conducted on sort of citizens in various states. I mean, marijuana, oddly enough, is kind of an understudied substance, considering how much people consume of it.
Thank you, federal government.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's prudent of Connecticut to sort of say, well, let's watch how this unfolds in Massachusetts. Let's see what happens. Let's see what kinds of things they should have thought about before they legalized this. For example, I don't think they have anything resembling a breathalyzer standard for what constitutes marijuana-impaired driving. So, I mean, I think we can all agree that if you smoke way too much pot, you will be somewhat impaired and in a way that's at least mildly comparable to alcohol. But I don't know that they necessarily have a way for their police to test for that or make a determination, you know, and there's like 29 other little variables that are probably, you know, let them try that. They can do the dry run and we'll see how that looks.
Well, it's all part of the devolution of culture, which, you know, we have to get to that big picture. I want to make a broad comment about Malloy, and he's in the type of situation, which is why his approval rating is at 24%, which is going to go up in the next Q poll. In a number of different areas, casinos we talked about, marijuana, tax increase versus support, you know, state services. We all know that, or at least in this room we know, that the problem isn't current services. The problem is old obligations. And so if the only way to save money is to cut current services and you get into a spiral that way. The flight of billionaires, support for for Hillary Clinton as a surrogate in all these areas, General Electric. He can't win. He's in a situation where he can't win. If he does one thing, he's attacked. And if it doesn't work out, he's attacked. And if he does the other, it's a very difficult situation to be in. And not to defend the governor, but there are a number of things like that when things start going wrong that play that way.
Well, I always thought, and you know, I worked for Governor Weicker at the time where he decided that it was going to be one term and done after putting in the state income tax. But he always believed that had he run again, it would probably be a 3-way race. He probably would have won, despite the fact that he was wildly unpopular when it came to the income tax. So I think there's a lot of Weicker in Malloy when it's kind of like an I'll show you.
Quick phone call here from Michael. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in on the legalization of marijuana subject as it pertains to the economy in Connecticut. And number one, a comment that you guys had made earlier about there being some sort of a breathalyzer or test, they actually do have devices for that the police officers can use to study impairment. And there's also sobriety tests that can be done as well as related to marijuana. But even beyond that, the taxation of marijuana is probably one of the most powerful things that can be done in a state right now. And it affects all kinds of things, particularly industrial things, not just the medicine and the recreational use like alcohol, but also industry. There's all kinds of industries that will be affected and get a boost from the legalization of marijuana and hemp products, and it's a really important thing that can be done.
Well, and Michael, thank you very much for that. I will just say that in looking at the Massachusetts model, looking at a little bit in what's happened in Colorado, there are some downstream effects on the economy, but you have to tax it the right way. And I think some of actually what's happened in industry in Colorado, Colin, has been that there's a gray or black market industry that's cropped up around getting legal weed out of Colorado into other states that don't have it, which is another problem that maybe Connecticut law enforcement has to deal with. Not to put aside everything that Michael said, but that is one of the impacts on, well, quote-unquote, industry.
Yeah, again, nothing about this suggests to me that it would be unwise to watch this unfold, particularly at an adjacent state. I mean, Connecticut will have a very nice chance to watch and find out what Massachusetts didn't figure out about the unintended consequences. And, you know, there may be breathalyzers and stuff like that. The last time I read about the Massachusetts situation, though, they didn't have the regs or the practices to go with that. So maybe they do now. I mean, I haven't made this my life study. But
I'm sorry. 2 points. Number one, as soon as it passed in Massachusetts, the leadership of the House and Senate said, oops, we're not taxing it enough. We're going to go back in. We're going to rewrite the law. We're going to tax it more because it clearly wasn't enough. And secondly, the governor of Rhode Island, Raimondo, has already said that as soon as Massachusetts legalizes it, we're going to fast track it. There will not be stores to buy pot until 2018 in Massachusetts. Providence and Rhode Island wants to jump that and start it right now.
I think it is.
So on two borders, we'll have pot.
It is important to say that the governor of Massachusetts, a lot of the statewide elected officials, there are a whole lot of people who didn't want this referendum to go through, Danny, but it did in Massachusetts.
It's the same thing that happened with Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado. He didn't want it, and then he became a sort of a pragmatic advocate for doing it right. And his advice when he came to Connecticut 2 years ago was don't rush into it because there are problems you're not foreseeing.
And I told my wife, if we legalize in Connecticut, you know, I'll gladly give my liver a couple-year break to support the medical marijuana, the marijuana industry. I think that'd be a good thing for a lot of people who just, you
your
know.
Lungs won't thank you.
Yeah, your lungs won't thank you. Let's turn quickly to something that we think will probably be on the agenda. Representative Tong has said in a Facebook post, here's the first bill submitted for drafting in the next legislative session. It's my proposal for an amendment to the state constitution to allow early voting. Colin, is something that we've talked with the Secretary of State about an awful lot. Connecticut kind of behind the times on that. I mean, do you see, we were talking about maybe going slow on something like marijuana legislation. Here's one where we've seen a lot of other states get into early voting. Should we be tapping the brakes on this?
I think we shouldn't be. You know, I think we have gone slow. And I think, you know, expanding participation is basically a good thing. This is an example of something about which I have had a change of heart. I was initially not in favor of this. But I don't know. I mean, it seems to me getting more people involved and getting more people to the polls is, you know, on balance, a pretty good thing. And I think it's an idea whose time has come. It does require a constitutional amendment, which makes it kind of a hard charge. But we could probably get there.
Are we moving toward frequent voting as well, or is it just early voting?
So, well, we already have frequent voting.
Actually, that actually is not the only electoral reform that we're going to see. We're going to see something about dark money and and special interest money in Connecticut. Whether that's going to be constitutional or not, we'll have to see in light of Citizens United. But we will see a bill coming from the House on that.
Didn't we already pass legislation about that stuff? Didn't we already try to get dark money? And
no, we tried. We tried on the supply side by creating huge pool, a huge $11 million pool of money for statewide candidates to run on, and that's working. But as we've learned this past cycle with CBIA and a number of other, Grow Connecticut, other money comes in. And when that happens, there may be ways to look at that and control that.
Tom?
Well, first of all, on the early voting thing, I think a lot of the Republicans just look at it as a Democratic, incumbency act. So I think a lot of people are going to be against it. But there's other things we can do to streamline our own election process to make voting easier. You know, every time I go to vote, there's like these tables with these people with rulers crossing off your name, looking for your name through these sheets of paper and writing down numbers. I mean, if we just get rid of that, we can just walk into the voting booth, give me a ballot, let me vote, let me get out of there. Done deal. I don't need to vote.
I want to quickly turn before our break to we haven't got a chance to talk to you about this, Danny. Luke Bronin going around to suburban towns, West Hartford, Rocky Hill. He's in Simsbury. He's trying to sort of make the case to help Hartford help the region. And it's in some ways a one-man show. I mean, what's he hearing from the towns, the outlying towns?
Polite response in West Hartford and Rocky Hill, but the undercurrent is niet. but nonetheless, a very polite response. Actually, one of his toughest critics in Rocky Hill was Senator Doyle, who basically got up and said, he did the old my good friend routine. And essentially behind the my good friend routine was forget about it. The one point I would make is that he's not actually asking for anything from these towns. He's asking for them to be part of a base of support for statewide assistance.
Well, I think that's what our friend Chris Powell from the Journal Inquirer has always said, that there needs to be more involvement in the suburbs in Hartford. And Powell has even gone as far as to say that he thinks people in the suburbs should vote for people in Hartford to go to that level.
I think Luke had a pretty good line. He said, you can't be a suburb of nothing. there's that herb in there, And I do think
it's off the floor.
It's a very, very tough sell in this particular place. I wasn't at the Rocky Hill thing, but I read in the coverage, I thought he got a he had a tougher audience there than he had in West Hartford. But I mean, look, what you have is a whole bunch of suburbs who think that they really have no connection whatsoever to Hartford. And part of this is because just the way this area is laid out. Hartford is, 15, 16 square miles, this tiny little postage stamp surrounded by a bunch of suburbs that don't want to, they want hospitals and stuff like that to be there, but they don't want to have to deal with Hartford.
I just want to quickly say, because we have to take a break, but Tom, I'll just push back a little, and this is probably something I should address to Chris Powell as opposed to through you to Chris Powell. But sometimes the way Mr. Powell writes about people who live in Hartford might suggest that the people in the outlying towns might not have exactly the correct view of what life is like in the city.
Yes, I would tend to agree with that, but I think you'd have a spirited conversation with Chris on this in back of this microphone.
And gold, too. Talk about gold while you're here.
and bring back G. Fox, Colin. That'll get people into Hartford again.
Here we go. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the big stories of the year that maybe we haven't talked about yet, some interesting stories that are happening right now. That's happening next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking with Tom Dudchick from ctcapitalreport.com, also Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe. A couple of minutes to go through some of the stories of this week and this year, including this one from Sheldon. Last week, a group called Freedom from Religion erected a sign on the Huntington Green celebrating the winter solstice, calling religion a myth and a superstition. On Monday, another sign went up right next to it reading, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays from the City of Sheldon. I did that. I'm a Merry Christmas guy, Mayor Mark Loretti told The Current on Tuesday. I also have a right to do so. Oh, we're back to the war on Christmas, Colin. You're talking about Jesus this afternoon. What's your take?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm a big believer in the establishment clause. There shouldn't be mangers and creches or and things like that on town greens. That's what churches are for. You put the manger on your church property. And, you know, and as much as possible, I think stuff like this should be kept off government property. But I also feel as though atheists, as they become a bigger factor in society, and they're going to become a bigger factor in society, and millennials tend not to you know, participate in religion. If you add up all the people who are either atheist, agnostics, or so-called nuns, N-O-N-E, that kind of nun, you get about 23%, which is roughly the number of the percentage of voters who are regular participants in a religion. But, you know, so as atheists become a bigger factor, they have to make sure that they don't sound like the intolerant, aggressive Christians that they feel have tormented them for decades. And I thought this sign was rude. You know, it used words like superstition and enslavement and stuff like that. So, you know, I understand that if you're an atheist, maybe you felt a little cornered at times in your life. But don't turn into the atheist Bill O'Reilly. You're just going to be the same kind of jerk with a different ideology.
Picking up on that comment, I think that those of us who are practicing non-Christians, myself being Jewish, we worry that the backlash against it could be worse than the thing itself. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, look, as a non-Christian, don't stop saying Merry Christmas for me. That's not doing me any favors. I wish the Hartford Courant every December 25th would say Merry Christmas across the top, because that actually happens to be what the day is. Today is Solstice Day, so I will say Good Solstice. And that's where I worry about the backlash more than I worry about the initial effect.
And there is, and that is true. And someone who adopted children late in his life and was never subjected to these kind of Christmas shows in middle school. I mean, it is. I mean, there is like truly no Christmas stuff. They go out of their way to, like, you know, talk about trees and, you know, snow and, you know, but certainly not about the baby Jesus, as Colin talking about later today. Nothing.
Okay, so here's another story. Norwalk Public School officials yanking hundreds of social studies books from the fourth grade classrooms across the district after a mother raised concerns over the book teaching her fourth grade daughter that slaves in Connecticut were cared for like family members. The book is called The Connecticut Adventure. We're taking that story, Colin, from the Norwalk Hour.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is, I mean, I'm not a big believer in book bans and stuff like that, but this book is, that depiction of slavery is pretty screwed up. And it's, you know, I mean, we know from Ann Farrow's book, Complicity, you know, that the Connecticut's involvement in the slave trade is pretty huge, and ways in which the Connecticut economy was built on the back of the slave trade is very significant. And, you know, I mean, if you're going to you're going to teach some people about slavery, don't do this Gone with the Wind stuff where the slaves are really happy, they really liked their relationship with their masters, and don't ignore all these other far-reaching economic consequences. Well, so, yeah, I don't like that book. I'm happy to see it go.
No, but I still think, you know, getting back to my comment about being an old generational parent, you can go through textbooks and curriculum, and you can do a whole program on this same issue. My kids would come home with, like, the weekly readers, and there'd be, like, solar panels and you know, and windmills on these things, and talking about how fossil fuels are so evil. You know, there's never a weekly reader that says, you know, coal miners for America, you know, and coal powering the American economy. So I think there is a lot of biases in every issues, you know, when it comes to where our kids are taught.
Yeah, but there's a difference between bias and being historically correct.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and so I think we probably want history books to be historically correct. I mean, for the most part.
Speaking of history, Connecticut, continuing with the theme of slow adaptation, that book came out in 2001. It's 2016 that we're talking about here. And so it took 15 years. I believe the book was in use much of that time in Norwalk. For 15 years, nobody bothered about it. And all of a sudden, it comes up. I think that's telling in a way.
And there was a mural, too, I believe, in Norwalk. They had some racist depictions on there that they removed. And that was up there for generations.
Right.
I will say the book was written in 2001. How did that book get written in 2001? I mean, my textbooks that said that sort of thing when I was going to school were written in the 1950s. I guess I can get that. I don't know how a 2001 textbook has that particular information in it. But I want to move on to some of the big stories of the year that maybe we haven't talked about, or just fun stories, interesting stories. I will say one of the things that happened this week is one of my favorite stories of the year. The owners of Bear's Smokehouse in Hartford raising the minimum wage for the majority of their employees to $15 an hour as of January 1st. Making a statement about the debate over the increasing minimum wage. This is a plan that was hatched by the owners of Bears. They say they can afford to do it. They want to reward hardworking employees. They want to get better employees. They're not saying anybody else has to do it. It's amazing, though, Colin, although I shouldn't be reading the comments in the Hartford Courant, a lot of people were very upset at the owners of Bears about raising the minimum wage.
How dare they run their business the way they want to? Yeah, no, I'm with you. I applaud beers. And look, if you know anything about, you know, the cost of living in Connecticut, I mean, the notion that you could live in Connecticut on much less than $15 an hour is ludicrous, too. So, yeah, I think this is a great thing, and I let them be an example to others.
And I think that's the point. That's the point the Republicans in the legislature and across the country makes. Look, this is not government's role to decide what business works, what works best for a business. They've decided $15 works best for them. It gives their employees incentive to come to work. God bless them.
When a successful business can afford the differential of $1.3 million a year to pay its workers more, that's a fantastic thing. That does not help workers who are making the minimum wage today.
I want to
except those who work there, and that's one.
I want to ask Tom for what's a story that you really loved from this year, a story or two.
Well, I think again, just like the Bears thing, I think Senator Looney has a new kidney, and I think that's a good thing.
That's a very good thing, and we wish him a quick recovery. We were talking last week about just how quick that recovery might be in order to get back into the chamber. How about you, Dan?
Hey, can we just say the other day, the name Judge Brian Fisher, I think is his name. Let's applaud the kidney donor, you know, particularly here at Christmas time. That's something that, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing to do.
It's like, you know, I kid people, you know, when it was announced he has, you know, the good news and bad news. The good news is he got a kidney donor. The bad news, it's Colin McEnroe who's giving you his kidney.
Nobody wants my kidney.
I don't know if the kidney would be the problem. I don't know that it's a warm, fuzzy story, but I think a really important story that we can't forget and keep watching is the flight of the billionaires in Connecticut, because it doesn't take too many of those to change the nature of the state.
The flight of the billionaires. Colin?
I'm going to go with a fuzzy but not warm story, and particularly since we're talking about bears, I'm going to bring up another animal. You know, like Time Magazine, they have their person of the year and stuff like that. So my person of the year for Connecticut is not a person but is a beaver, the angry beaver of Killingly, which I believe appeared on Tom's site as well. So in August, this beaver in the Quinebaug River, people would go in swimming in the Quinebaug River, and the beaver would swim over and bite them. And to me, that just sums up 2016 perfectly, you know, because beavers usually are pretty shy. I mean, I go kayaking around them, and they, you know, they would kind of want to avoid human contact. But this beaver was so pissed off, you know, and I think he speaks for a lot of Americans and people in Connecticut.
So, Tom, what were people clicking on this year? I mean, you put all these stories up. You aggregate news stories all year long. I mean, what are the trends as far as what people were really interested in?
Well, I think Colin hit the nail on the head. Despite all the weighty issues that we put on CT Capital on a daily basis, it's the quirky stuff that really gets people to think. And I think because, you know, there is a certain amount of comic relief that people just want to take a breather every now and then and just read something funny and interesting. And that drives a lot of traffic.
Well, it drives a lot of traffic, but I mean, give me a sense of some of those stories. I mean, do you have like a magic story like, oh, my goodness, yes, the beaver biting people who are swimming is absolutely going to get people clicking on it?
I can answer this question because I've contacted Tom sometimes when I've been writing end of the year pieces.
Yeah.
He doesn't remember anything that's been
happening. That's true. That's true. I mean, I live in the moment, John. It goes away, you know, tomorrow.
And then I see, are there any frame grabs? Could I look at the page day by day? No.
I'm not going to be any help here either as far as the specific one. But I remember, like a good candidate, you remember how you feel. The tweet that got the most response from me this year, and I use Twitter, you know, sort of a little bit grudgingly, it was not any politics thing that I tweeted, but it was a bumper sticker that was funny. And dang if I can remember what it was, but it was a funny bumper sticker, and it got like 1,200 retweets or some crazy number like that. And I guess that's a lesson for something. It's not as telling as the beaver, but it's out there.
Colin, we just have a minute or so left. I mean, I think the thing after a year like this, when we have so many terrible stories to grapple with, whether or not it's something horrifying happening overseas, it's an incredibly contentious election, all of our heroes are dying. I mean, we went on air and did a whole hour about, you know, the impact that David Bowie had in our lives, and he was just one of many, many people who were very important to us who died this year. I mean, when we look back at a year like this, what do we think? We're going to talk about this on the nose a little bit this upcoming week. But, I mean, it's not all bleak, but sometimes it feels that way.
You know, the day after the election, I interviewed Azar Nafisi, the Iranian, now Iranian-American writer who wrote Reading Lolita in Tehran. One thing she said is the best way to respond, the best way to dissent, the best way to respond when you feel repressed is to become more completely yourself. And in a way, you know, that might be a message that I would offer to people coming forward into 2017. If you feel as though the world is stacked against you or the world has turned into a place that you don't want to live in anymore, become more yourself. Do the things that you do, even the simplest things, you know, the music that you make or the nature that you enjoy or the garden that you cultivate. Do those things more completely and more wholeheartedly. And I think that'll translate into strength and action as you face darker nights.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Thanks so much, Colin.
Thank you.
Thanks to Tom Dutchick, the editor of ctcapitalreport.com. Even though we don't remember all the great stories of the year, Tom, I really appreciate you bringing them to us. Thank you very much. Thanks also to Dan Harr for all the great columns and for joining us so often here in the Wheelhouse. Thank you very much. And a happy new year to all of you. Our technical producer, Kion Wolf, WMPR's digital editor, is Heather Brandon. Thanks to the executive producer, Katie Tolarski. And thanks to CTN for being here and taking pictures of us all year long. This is the Wheelhouse.